aspects to it that I'm not the biggest fan for. It has some issues. And so recently, LastPass actually got breached. And now they claimed that the main master password database did not get breached, but you never know. The fact remains is that some of the content was breached. And one of the kind of Achilles heels of these types of systems is that they are hosted someplace. So instead of it being a file on your computer that you are using two-factor authentication in order to unlock, and that your endpoint has to specifically be hacked in order for your password safe to be breached. In this case, hackers can spend a lot of effort on a targeted attack of a giant attractive honeypot target like LastPass. And in doing so, they know what they're getting, or they know what their reward is potentially for this. So LastPass is a browser integrated password manager tool. Now you can certainly use it for other passwords, to manage other passwords, but I don't use it for that. And I don't use LastPass for anything that is like, really sensitive things like online banking and such. So it is, I think LastPass is a decent option for a password manager in terms of a convenience tool. It is clearly a much better option than simply telling the browser to actually cache the passwords. I mean, that's truly a horrific option. If you're using Firefox or Chrome or Internet Explorer in order to cache passwords for sites, again, that's truly a horrific solution. There's really inadequate quantities of encryption for that. And there's way too many approaches that hackers use that are specifically targeted to harvest the contents of cached passwords in browsers. So I'd really highly recommend against that strategy. So LastPass is a good middle ground. It is browser integrated. It can save you a lot of time by automatically logging you on to certain websites. It also offers flexible options in terms of how much security you want to have. So, as an example, let's say you had a system that had an encrypted hard drive, and then you decided that because your system is Active Directory integrated and you are using complex passwords with Kerberos authentication and NTLM-V2, and you've got digital signing on LDAP connections, and you've got firewalls and host-based security product, and you change your password frequently and you're using complex passwords, right? So you've really got a good strategy in place. You could make an argument, and I think I would support you in this argument. You could make an argument that under that context, simply successfully logging onto that Windows computer under that level of a security assumption, that LastPass could unlock based upon logging in to Windows successfully. So you can actually prevent yourself from having to log in to LastPass. Like, it'll just do Windows integrated authentication. That is a convenience feature. And I said it the way that I said it previously to help you understand that if you don't otherwise have adequate security to protect that, then that's really not the appropriate strategy. Instead, you need to be doing something like, okay, yeah, we're going to use LastPass, but we're also going to have a master password in order to unlock it, and that your LastPass password safe does not open up, it does not unlock until you put in a master password, which of course it is required that you memorize that. If you're keeping the password for your LastPass safe in a text file on your computer, well, then what security do you really have? Okay. So that's one scenario where you could use LastPass for fully Windows integrated authentication. It unlocks it, then as you pop into websites, it'll basically automatically log you on. So it really is a huge time saver tool. It's very convenient when employed properly, and it can still be very secure. That being said, though, I still would not utilize it as a universal solution. It is my preference to utilize a separate password manager for things that are more critical. So, now let's talk about a different scenario, which is you're using a local password safe as an example. You're not going to get those sorts of browser integrated authentication, and maybe that's okay. Because clearly there is a vulnerability in terms of with LastPass, if you are using a tool like that, while it offers you the convenience of cloud storage for your cached passwords in their encrypted storage, that would then allow you to be able to have, let's say you had five different devices that you use LastPass on. That would be okay. And it would seamlessly kind of cloud synchronize. It's technically it's not cloud synchronization. It's just whenever you're using LastPass, it's going across the internet and it is using the passwords in their encrypted storage in order to unlock the things for you. Now, obviously, the ramification of that is that using LastPass in order to unlock things while you have no internet connection, well, that's a problem. That's not going to work. So I'm trying to draw a lot of distinctions here so that you can understand that no one password management tool is a nirvana. You need to be educated about which password management tool to utilize compared to, other other various strategies. So as a recap, LastPass is great for websites that are not your banking websites. If you want browser-integrated authentication with passwords, then LastPass is a great tool for that. And it can make all of those passwords accessible to you from your different devices. Now, on the other hand, it's not accessible unless you have an internet connection. And it is associated with a giant honeypot target that not only have the hackers targeted and successfully breached to some degree, but they're going to continue to go after it. It's not like LastPass ceases to be an attractive target. It's definitely an attractive target, will continue to be so, but at the same time, the people at LastPass are pretty intelligent and they continue to work on closing holes all the time. The reality is that we live in a very, very, very dynamic threat landscape, and because of that, there is this necessity to always be working on closing the new gaps. And there's always new gaps. So whatever you have as a strategy, if you've patched things and you've penetration tested them and so forth, well, you just have to do it again tomorrow. I mean, literally, it's if you're in the IT security business, you've really just got to have a lot of raw endurance. Really. I mean, it's serious. You've really got to enjoy it. Yeah, otherwise, I think it could really depress some people. So I say that because for those of you that have no interest in spending your time doing such things, please have appreciation for people like myself that make a living doing that and that seek to continue to try to find ways to help protect you. It is a very difficult job what we're doing. Okay, I'm going to move on to the topic now of the US federal sites are now required to use HTTPS. This was, of course, a declaration by the federal government, and it was recently covered in CIO.gov on their website, CIO.gov. The thing that I have to say about that is, it's about time. I mean, it's just funny. It's truly funny. HTTPS was a standard more than a decade ago, maybe 15 years ago, prior to that even. And I mean, there's all kinds of different versions of HTTPS where actually HTTPS SSL version 3 and all kinds of different layers of TLS on top of that. And there's just a whole bunch of interesting little tangential functions that are enhancements to the way that SSL and TLS work. And of course, HTTPS is about, it's about SSL and TLS primarily is what that's about, without going too far into the weeds. But the thing that's amazing is that these technologies are so mature that they've gone through dozens of iterations of improvements and enhancements and tweaks around the side. And yet, it's finally been the federal government has decided, oh, yes, I think we should actually start using HTTPS. I find it's rather interesting that it's kind of this confluence of events all simultaneously. You had all the Obamacare website drama, and how that was just so brazenly and easily hackable, and despite SSL, it's just the thing was just so horrifically poorly implemented. And then SSA, the Social Security Administration, they got breached, and it was through their website. And then they had to improve how they were doing authentication. They turned on two-factor authentication capabilities and all kinds of things. And as you heard before from me, Google and LinkedIn and Facebook and many other providers like Twitter, they just went to HTTPS for everything back in January. And this has created quite a bit of an issue, especially for schools that receive E-rate funding or any location that wishes to have a content filtering policy just for good common sense. I mean, it's one thing to say, well, we're going to block naughty content because it is against our policy to allow people to see that kind of content during appropriate work hours. It is still, there's another element to that, which is that you also have to be inspecting content because we have been living in the realm of Web 2.0 for at least the last 15 years. And what I mean by that is, for those of you that don't know what Web 2.0 is, it's effectively embedded content. So if you go to yahoo.com, you're getting a lot of content from a lot, and I mean a lot, of different other sources other than Yahoo simply when you go there. And so you think you're going to Yahoo, but you're really getting content from 30 other sources. So with Web 2.0, there was all of this embedded content that came from all of these other different sources that you seriously need to be concerned about. In fact, I would argue that that embedded content is more often than not the source of the attack vector. And I mean, we only need to recall the Yahoo embedded malvertisements issue from March 2015, where Yahoo was infecting hundreds of thousands of machines per hour. I mean, it was just astonishing. And that issue, if that doesn't expose the whole embedded content issue to you, then I don't know what other example I'd give you. I mean, that's pretty about as typical as it is, and that's about as brazen as it gets, where you're infecting hundreds of thousands of machines per hour. But this should illuminate the fact that you absolutely have to inspect content for malicious content, not just inappropriate content. And it's really important to me that you understand that there are major, uncompromising reasons why you have to do deep packet inspection. Yes, you need to keep young eyes away from inappropriate content, Furthermore, you need to make sure that your employees are only seeing the intended appropriate content throughout the daytime while they're trying to do their job. But it's also an enormous factor that you have to keep your machines working. And the way that you keep your computers working is you keep the malicious content off of them. But if everything is HTTPS and you are not doing deep packet inspection, you have no visibility into those packets, and it is very widely known that this is happening, and so as a result, the bad guys out there are making it their standard modus operandi to do everything across SSL. They are stealing certificates, they have colluded with CNNIC to get certificates from CNNIC. Let's not forget the entire drama where Google and other providers like Firefox and Microsoft have decided that we're not going to trust CNNIC anymore, and obviously you shouldn't either. I think that change was actually made to Chrome as well, where it doesn't trust certificates from CNNIC anymore. So DPI is still this tough nut to crack. I do have a little bit of positive information for you along the lines of this very difficult situation. And that is that due to the enormous outcry from schools, Google has finally decided that they are going to offer I'm not going to call it a compromise, but it's a kind of a workaround. And I have tested it. It does work. You can have not necessarily DPI, but you can at least force safe search with Google Things if you can control or can control, if you have your own internal DNS servers, what it comes down to. So if you're trying to do DPI for your guest network, which is very necessary, let's say you happen to manage the guest wireless network for a church, well, this is not going to be something that just willy-nilly let every content go is going to be an appropriate scenario. I don't think so. I think you're still going to want to have content filtering for your guests in that church. So unless you can put a DNS server in there as an intermediary, which becomes very problematic because you need to be doing what's called wireless client isolation, then you really can't make use of this safe search enforcement mechanism without going full DPI. And as soon as you go full DPI, you break all kinds of things. I mean, it's still a tough nut to crack, but the world is getting better with regards to this. There is a viable option, at least based upon the testing that I've done up to this point. There's no real decent published article on this, but I have come up with a way to force safe search even for encrypted traffic for Google-related things. And then, of course, you can fit that into a plan that says, this is how we're going to do it for Yahoo, this is how we're going to do it for Bing and all the other search engines and so forth. So it is getting better out there. If this is something that you want to know how to do, you can certainly contact me. So I want to wrap up the rest of the show here talking about a recent breach that occurred through spear phishing attack and then what you can learn from it. And this was a recent thing that I became aware of, and it had to do with a financial-related institution. And the way that their systems were breached was a targeted spear phishing attack was set up, and it was sent to certain individuals that had been determined to be the people that would be handling the accounting-related functions in the organization. And then, because they did not have adequate security protections in place, then malicious bad doo-doo from that spear phishing attack email executed on their machine and it grabbed content and uploaded it and a variety of things. So, we talk about the fact that in order to have adequate security, you really do have to have a lot of things in place. But it's interesting when we talk about this particular incident, there's a whole litany of any number of layers of appropriate security that could have actually stopped this particular breach. And so I think the thing that should be encouraging to you is that, you do layers of defense so that it's at least one of your layers of defense that's going to stop the breach. And yes, they're all important, but the thing that should be encouraging is that it only takes one layer. The problem is you just don't know which layer you need in order to stop the attack. And then the other thing that I think is very encouraging is that this was completely preventable. So what that means is there's already well-established tactics in order to solve this problem. And I've published on this particular topic for years now. So if you are looking for a formulaic "how do I get it done for myself" approach, just go to my website, qualityplusconsulting.com. Take a look at my articles associated with Computers and Security Self-Assessment, the IT Security Standards and Best Practices Guide, and then you need to read about what really are security appliances. You need to understand what security appliances are. So if you hit up those three articles, you're going to really learn a lot. And it's in many cases quite formulaic on what it is that you need to do in order to solve this problem. So let's recap the incident briefly. Basically, environment allowed users to browse the internet and to do email as an admin level account or as an account that had the ability to do direct privilege escalation. UAC was disabled, which is user account control, because of the fact that they used a third-party application that was incompatible with UAC. So in that sort of circumstance, this is insane. And I do mean insane, and I'm not being flippant about the use of that terminology. If you are going to be an accountant accessing banking websites that have obviously large account balances because you are an organization that has a lot of employees. I mean, even if it's just your payroll account, you're still going to have a lot of money in there because you have a lot of payroll to do. So in that circumstance, it is literally insane to be doing email and browsing the general internet from a computer that you are have any online banking, anything associated with it, and then you're browsing the internet as an administrative account without UAC even turned on. I mean, this is just truly crazy town. So the one thing that saved this organization from getting their bank account liquidated was that they were intelligent enough to set up what's called two-party authorization for account transfers. So there's an attempt for a large sum of money to be transferred using through ETF, electronic funds transfer, or I should say EFT, electronic funds transfer. And what stopped the transfer from going was that the second person had to actually authorize that transfer, and of course they caught it at that point and said, "Whoa, we did not initiate this transfer," because it was simply one person's credentials that had been compromised. Now, this person who was browsing the internet as an admin account didn't have training to see that it was clearly a spear phishing attack. Don't open this malicious macro-based piece of malware that is going to put a command and control application on the machine, grab all your local files and upload it, and then certainly anything that you have access to on the network as well. And so there was the perimeter device did not have, there's no SIM logging in place. So in terms of like tracking it, you don't know what's going on. There was no egress filtering, so can't stop it there. No ingress filtering, can't stop it there. No, the host-based security product was improperly configured, didn't stop it there. The user wasn't trained on how to avoid security problems, so it didn't stop it there. And the user was allowed to browse the internet as an admin account. Well, so clearly it didn't stop it there. And I think, as an even bigger cacophony of errors, that machine was not kept patched fully. So, didn't stop it there. Any one of these layers could have actually stopped it. And as I said, fortunately enough, it wasn't a computer IT security method that stopped the breach. It was a, let's put a checks and balances system in place to make sure that nobody can transfer large sums of money out of our account without two people being aware of that. And so when you have an organization and you need to have two people sign checks, that's great. You should clearly also have at least two people have to authorize bank transfers. And I suggest that you set a threshold limit as well that says if the threshold for, if the EFT request exceeds a certain dollar amount, then not only do these two people have to authorize it, but the bank needs to call at least one person and get one person whose voice they know. And maybe they have some sort of PIN number or something that they have to verbally disclose. In that circumstance, the bank actually should call and validate, yes, you intended to make this EFT. That's an option as well that you can use. So there are a number of effective techniques that you can very easily implement. One, properly secure your host-based security product, put a proper unified threat management appliance in place, train your people, please train your people. It is even possible that the email server security needs to be analyzed in terms of, here's this spear phishing attack, why wasn't it caught? Now, granted, I'm going to give a little bit of leeway and grace to the email hosting platform because it was a very, very, and I mean a very targeted spear phishing attack to the point where the bad guys went to the effort of hooking up and setting up a very close domain name, very close to the organization that they were seeking to attack, very closely named domain name. And so when it's something that is so tightly targeted like that, then, you know, you're looking at anybody who's doing hosted email security, they are not seeing trends and patterns to analyze that are hitting a bunch of, you know, people simultaneously to then say, oh, well, you know, we're seeing a trend and pattern here. We better put something in place to block that. So you need to be aware that simply relying upon your hosted email security platform to protect you against spear phishing, well, it's probably not going to happen because it's spear phishing. So we have to utilize the rest of these security layers. And again, it's pretty formulaic. Please hit up my website, educate yourself, take action, and prevent these issues. So that's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. As always, please do send me your feedback and comments to breakfastbites@gmail.com.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by John Nicholson, a retired Racine Unified administrator, Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconser, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning, and welcome to Education Matters. My name is Mike Kehoe, and I'm one of the rotating producer hosts This week we're deviating from our agenda so that we can